This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody. This is your host, Geert, and today we'll be talking to Dr. Gian Maria Campidelli. He's a postdoctoral research fellow in computational sociology and criminology at the University of Trento in Italy. And for an already impressive list of crime-related publications using innovative computational methods, check out his website. He is here today to discuss with us his new book, Machine Learning for Criminology and Crime Research, at the Crossroads, and it's published in June 2022 through Routledge. Gian, welcome.
Hi, Geert. Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here today. Thank you again, and good morning to everyone, hi to everyone who's listening.
So, just to start off, could you tell us a bit about yourself, professionally speaking, and where you come from?
Sure. So I'm a postdoctoral research fellow in the Department of Sociology and Social Research here in Trento. Before that, I was a PhD student, a doctoral student in the Catholic University of Milan. I worked there for 3 years as well in Transcrime, which is a research center on transnational crime. It's a joint one between Catholic University, University of Bologna, and University of Perugia here in Italy. And then I had an experience as a visiting research scholar at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh in 2018 within the School of Computer Science under the working in the group of Kathleen Carley, who was actually the advisor of my thesis. So that's basically my path. Actually, the curriculum, it's pretty hybrid. So I come from a social science tradition, but I moved during my doctorate towards more computationally oriented methods and perspectives to study of crime in general, and particularly terrorism and organized crime and violent crime. So yes, that's it. I don't want to be boring, but that's the kind of that path that I want to that I'd like to summarize. That's it basically. I'm working as a postdoctoral research fellow, like continuing the research that I started during my doctoral program, basically on the combination of complex networks and artificial intelligence for the study of terrorism, organized crime, and violent crime, homicide mostly.
And how did you come to write this book?
Well, that was a book that I had on the back of my mind for quite a long time relative to the stage where I'm at in my career. So not so long in absolute terms, but I started reasoning about the need for setting up some sort of reflection about the role that machine learning, artificial intelligence, more in general, might have in criminology and crime research. And I thought that that the time has come for writing it. The idea was really to try to take score of where we are, also acknowledging the origins and the legacies that actually got us where we are today, and trying also to reason about what possible perspectives in the future we might encounter, what challenges, what promises, and so that was. Partially, I would say that's the outcome of 3 or 4 years of reasoning and reflecting and discussing with colleagues about the role that this kind of new revolution in methodological terms, which is not just methodological, but had also theoretical implication might have on this field. And so that's basically the story behind the book and how I got to write it.
Yeah, I think it's great that you give us the technical details on this specific part of computational social science, but you also really paint a large historical background. In your, let me see. So when we get to the content, I guess, crime has been studied from a quantitative angle for quite some decades now. And most would say that we're taking a significant step by introducing AI and machine learning into the study of crime. But you give some nuance to that argument, saying that the use of these methods in criminology is not so very new. How so?
Well, yeah, I mean, exactly. I think that most of the narrative around this, which I call the novelty narrative, that's how I label it. I think it's motivated. So around the actual relationship between machine learning, computational methods, and crime in general, it's related to the big hype that these methods have in a lot of different fields, including criminology and crime research. And many people actually try to advertise or label this relationship as new. What I try to highlight and show in my book is that actually we have a long-standing tradition, and a tradition that actually has its roots back in the 80s, especially in the United States. So the people that already started to reason about the potential promises of these methods, of this set of methods for starting crime, but also preventing crime, countering crime. So not only the pure research pirate, but also the applied one, were started to be discussed back in the 80s. And in the book, I kind of discuss this by focusing on two different perspectives. So the first one is these roots that we had, especially in the applied sphere of the study of crime and the countering of crime, which again dates back to the 80s, but also a broader tradition of that actually looks at the intersections between sociology and artificial intelligence, and how the fathers of this kind of dialogue already were reasoning about, for example, the potential for theoretical explanation of AI within a sociological framework, but also how can we explain, how can we set a sociology of machines. And I think that, this missing part in most of the contemporary literature that really does not acknowledge the great questions and the great reflections that these scholars made more than 30 years ago, even 40 years ago. And I think that that's an essential part if we want to understand where we are today and if we want to understand where we're going. So the book starts with this kind of an orthodox introduction by expressing some sort of gratitude and calling people to recognize and to reconcile with the past that we had, because you know by reconciling and by recognizing it, we are more aware. We can be more aware of again where we are today, what are our roots, and where we should go tomorrow.
So you say already in the 80s there were quite some practical applications of these attempts at crime prediction as such, and one of the case studies is like the prediction of burglary in Baltimore, but you cite some different ones. Are these applications from the 80s or these studies from the 80s, are they like qualitatively different from what we are trying to do today in AI?
Well, I think that, as you mentioned, most of the applications were real applications, meaning that they were deployed by law enforcement mostly. And they were the effect of a renovated optimism that were spread within a lot of communities back in the 80s related to the promise of artificial intelligence, even though the 80s were somehow let's say an heterogeneous time frame for AI, where you know we witnessed. I wasn't born there, but let's say we witnessed a lot of failures, as well as a lot of optimism, and that kind of optimism spread out also to crime research and to crime control, crime prevention. I think that the applications are tremendously different in quantitative terms. So basically what kind of algorithms, the sophistication of the algorithms, but also the scale of the data that people use, that people deploy and that people like try to exploit for predicting crime. But I also think that the kind of the aim, the objective, the goal of these applications are not really different from now. I mean, they were all targeting the same kind of target, which was, you know, let's try to build like safer societies. And I think that some other kinds of, for example, issues that were discussed at the time. So there were people coming out from the computerized legal studies, for example, that were putting a lot of emphasis on the ability of the systems to create a fairer criminal justice system, for example, in the US, but in general, creating fairer society, not only safer society. And I think that this was some kind of point that was really emphasized by many champions of computational models and AI-based methods in crime research and crime prevention also in the last years, except for the fact that actually in many cases this was not the case. I mean, it was proved that it was demonstrated that these methods alone cannot really create a fairer society and actually can reinforce a lot of damages and a lot of disparities. But, you know, this kind of feeling that these methods, not only they work, but also they can do good to people, they can deliver social good, was already something that was in the discussion 30 years ago. And I think, you know, this parallelism are incredibly useful to really understand that basically people were seeing AI in the same way as most people see AI in crime research today.
So you go into the different sub techniques, so to say, that are contained in AI. And I guess the most important one that you go into is machine learning. Maybe to set the stage, what's the difference? What is machine learning, if you define it?
Well, yeah, so the first thing that I wanted to make clear is that this book was not thought as a textbook, so it's not too technical. I think the idea, my goal was to write a book that was accessible to everyone, to everybody, to all the people that have some interest, even, you know, a broader interest in the application of this method. So I have not devoted a lot of time in getting into the actual technical details. I think that the technical level is pretty accessible to everyone, even to people that do not have a background in statistics or computer science. So machine learning is basically a part, I would say, of AI. It's the kind of sets of methods that gain most attention in the social sciences. And it's basic, we can define it as basically as the intent to create programs or machines that are able to carry out some particular task without being programmed to do it. So without being explicitly programmed. And there are different, let's say, categorizations and dichotomies within machine learning. The most important one is the one between supervised and unsupervised learning. So supervised learning is basically all those sets of tasks and techniques that try, for example, to classify or predict some observation, having a target value available connected with a set of features. So learning the patterns that we have in the features to try to predict or to try to forecast or to try to classify some particular target variable. And we have within that classification and regression. And then we have unsupervised learning, which basically relates to a set of, let's say, tasks that are all characterized by the fact that we only have features. So we only have measurements about some observation without having a target variable. So we don't have anything to predict. And the idea is that we use those features to try to make order into the complexity of our observations. So, for example, finding clusters of similar objects or items, deriving density distributions, creating, setting up dimensionality reduction techniques. So there are two separate words. Most of the times they can be integrated. And again, it's just a part of AI. I think most of the times machine learning is rebranded directly as AI just to, again, reinforce this hype that's around artificial intelligence related topics and debates. And again, this is the kind of, let's say, the side of AI that mostly had the success along a lot of different fields, including criminology. So all those algorithms that we see generally, like random forest, decision trees, gradient boosting machines, but also PCA or K-means, dbScan, these are all methods that pertain to the tradition of machine learning within their separate subfields like supervised and unsupervised learning. That's the kind of explanation that I would give to people to remain as broad as possible.
Yeah, thanks for the background. So these are the methods, and you explain in detail the different let's say applications within criminology that are currently very promising. I think one of them relates to geospatial modeling, then another one is crime and networks, and the third one is crime simulation. Could you maybe explain a bit what these applications are, maybe with one or two examples?
Sure. So that chapter is built to take score of where we are today and the relationship between AI in general and crime research. And I argue in the book that this is kind of a fourth wave of, let's say, big changes in the methodological landscape within criminology. And the three topics that you touch upon are the previous ones. So we had a strong turn to quantitative research in criminology and crime research in the 20th century. And probably there was an acceleration in the last 20 years. And again, crime and networks, crime and geospatial modeling, and crime and agent-based simulations are, let's say, the three main champions of this acceleration. So I try to discuss where we are today within those three substream of research, showing that in the last 20 years, there have been massive efforts to try to, let's say, study crime, prevent crime, create application through for this method. So crime and networks actually pertain to the application of all those methods coming from social network analysis and network science and network theory, complex networks to the study of crime. So mostly considering the relational nature of crime by looking at connections between individuals, for example, connection between affiliates within terrorist groups. But also moving towards more like complex types of modeling, like for example, modeling different types of relationships without just looking at one type of connection between this people, or also considering connections between different layers of objects, like connections between individuals, but also connections between tasks, so connections between skills within criminal networks, for example. The second one is crime and geospatial modeling, which has been really on the spotlight, let's say, in the last years. It builds on the so-called law of crime concentration that was, delineated by Weisbord by considering the massive amount of research that was done in the last 30 years, looking at how crime concentrates in space and time. And the fact that, you know, this is just one of the very few kind of laws that we have in criminology that holds in different contexts. So the fact that actually crime, most of the crimes actually cluster in times and space was, the beginning of a very rich stream of research that tried to apply increasingly sophisticated models to try to predict crime by looking at by considering and by building and exploiting this concentration in time and space. And then we have a crime and simulation that probably is the, let's say, most recent stream of methodological innovation, which considers the simulation of crime dynamics by leveraging the flexibility, for example, of agent-based modeling. And it has been argued that this kind of simulation methods can overcome the limitation that most of the time we have in criminology in terms of experiments. Most of the times we cannot run experiments because they're costly, because there are ethical problems, and agent-based modeling and computer simulations actually seem to be a solution to that. I argue that we should be careful about this kind of position and the book, but certainly simulation methods are a powerful instrument that allow researchers to try to explore a lot of different scenarios within, very limited costs and within very limited timeframes, which is an important thing for a lot of reasons, especially for applied research. And again, I argue that maybe the combination, the link between criminology and artificial intelligence can be this new fourth stream of innovation in this field. And I think that this dialogue can be, let's say, unfolded through different ways, through different perspectives, and even integrating those methodological innovations that were already in place, like, crime and networks. I mean, you can combine network theory and artificial intelligence through graph learning, for example, to better understand how crime works. So, I think artificial intelligence can be a game changer. I'm not, super optimistic. I'm not one of those people that believe that AI alone will revolutionize our field, will create a better world. I think a lot of challenges, but still, I do think that when carried out properly and when deployed properly, we have a lot of potential for the future in our field by leveraging the potential of machine learning and artificial intelligence.
And of course, I would agree that experiments are a very tricky thing in criminology. And the hopes are high in this sense when it comes to simulation, but why are you hesitant to put your hopes on that? What are the risks?
Well, so the thing is that any simulation, no matter how powerful your machine is, no matter how detailed your software is, it's going to be just a simulation. I mean, we know that the world, social world, is extremely complex, is extremely nonlinear, it's extremely non-stationary, it's extremely skewed in many distribution that can describe human behavior. And so the thing that you know, just simulating something will be a good and an exact replacement of the complexity of reality. It's simplistic and it's dangerous. So I do believe that agent-based simulations, simulations in general, can be good tools to try to, let's say, streamline some questions, to investigate some hypotheses, but they cannot be deemed as a perfect replacement for experiments, especially because, you know, if we want to simulate a society or a part of a society, a community in general, we need an incredibly detailed and rich amount of data, which are generally not available for a lot of different reasons, because, you know, we are not capable of tracking those data, of recording those data, because many times you could simply cannot, thank God, record those data. So it's always going to be some sort of, let's say, an approximation, depending on the level of sophistication, depending on the level of richness of the data. The sophistication can be a better sophistication or worse sophistication or simplification, an approximation, sorry, but still an approximation. So I'm not an advocate for replacing experiments completely. But still, I do believe that we can kind of integrate real-world experiments with computer simulations to try to get closer to the answers to the questions that we pose ourselves.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Do you maybe have an example where it did work, such a simulation where you think it was a good application?
Well, so we're still in the early stages of this kind of modeling approaches, so the use of agent-based simulation, and there were some articles a couple of years ago that were actually taking stock of the state of the art, and the idea, I mean, the picture that was coming out of that was not particularly positive. I mean, there were a lot of problems in many of these papers that were using this methods, because, for example, of lack of transparency, you know, insufficient detail in describing the data and describing the mechanism that were coded to simulate a society itself. So I think there's, you know, we're very early in this practice. I actually worked on a project that was focusing on the integration between computational sciences and criminology by creating this agent-based modeling for understanding recruitment into organized crime and terrorism. It was a European project. I worked with that when I was at Catholic University. We worked with David Weisbord at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He and his team were working on the terrorism side. We were working on the organized crime side. There was not a deployment of the experiment of the artificial experiments in the real world, but I think that was already a good starting point, because which is very unusual in Italy. We sat down with prosecutors, people from the law enforcement, community leaders, and we set up this dialogue talking with institutions about, you know, how to set up this simulation. So we were, you know, in charge with the Italian National Research Council of coding the thing up, but we wanted to discuss you know, the hypothesis and the assumptions of this coding with people that were actually working in the field. And I think that was a virtuous experience because one of the things that I try to argue in the book is that, you know, these computational models, no matter how sophisticated they are, no matter how advanced they are, but they require expert knowledge. And even though, you know, we actually were simulating societies where we were interested in testing different policies to counter recruitment, even though those results in that simulation were not used in the real world, I think that they were still useful because when we delivered that to people that helped us and that were actually working in the field, they were impressed by, you know, the potential that these methods have. So I think it's always a matter of, you know, checks and balances. I mean, it's always a matter of dialogue between different fields, within different communities. And even though, you know, that simulation, we're not deployed again in the real world, we're not used to set up new policies, I would have been surprised of the country, especially in Italy. But even though that didn't happen, still it was a first step towards a better integration between communities, the scientific one, institutional one, the policymaking one. And that's the half full glass of that story.
Thanks. So I guess, well, many of us by now will be quite aware of certain risks of using AI on social situations. For instance, the propagation of existing biases like racism or other kinds of biases. Could you explain us a bit more about those specific risks of AI when applied to crime research?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this has been a field, I mean, an area of research in which there have been like a lot of attention, luckily, in the last years. I mean, and I dare to say that probably most of the research that came out on these topics came out from, not from criminology and crime research, but from computer science, mathematics, and statistics. Which is bad, I think. I mean, it's bad that these problems, these issues were addressed by people outside our community. I mean, it's fine that many people join the table, join the discussion, but I think that we as criminologists had a responsibility to be the first to raise our hands and make clear that something was wrong. So there are a lot of risks, really. I mean, it depends on the kind of application. There have been a lot of discussion, for example, about predictive policing. Predictive policing refers to a set of techniques that basically leverage the idea that crime concentrates in time and space. And by knowing that and using data on historical crimes or historical data on arrests, for example, the software are created so that law enforcement can dispatch their resources on a territory non-randomly, but looking at the patterns and the trends, historical patterns and trends that the past crime generated. And this kind of thing really now are everywhere, basically. The country definitely where the software are mostly deployed is the United States. But again, this is a global thing, and it's particularly worrisome because it's spread also to countries that are non-democratic. So countries in which, for example, the, you know, civil rights and liberties and the surveillance state is particularly prevalent. So that's a problem. But still, even in democratic countries, for example, geospatial predictive policing has a problem that it's generally these algorithms are generally trained on data that are biased because, first of all, if we talk about, like, for example, reported crimes, we know that people report crimes differently based on, you know, a lot of different features like, you know, background, socioeconomic background, race, or the part of the city in which you live, for example. So first of all, that's already a problematic measure of crime. And then in cases, for example, in which these algorithms are feed with RS data in countries in which RS data are RS are made out of biased and questionable policing practices in which you have like problems with race, for example, that's going to be another kind of problem. Again, I mean, you have data on arrests that are particularly biased against some groups, some, for example, like African-Americans or Latinos in the US. And that's going to create this so-called feedback loops. So basically, you're feeding the machines with data that are already biased, and you know, it's the usual garbage in, garbage out. If you feed a machine with data that are biased, the results of the algorithms, the prediction, the forecast are going to be biased as well. So you are basically reinforcing this kind of disparate attention towards certain communities. And that's problematic, especially in countries in which you have, you know, cities are segregated by race. So you still have quite a lot of, you know, black communities living in those neighborhoods and then white communities living in those neighborhoods, and you don't have some sort of heterogeneity, which is probably more the case of Europe. You know, we are cases where in which, you know, segregation is a problem in Europe, but probably less so than the United States. So that's one problem related to predictive policing, but also like criminal justice risk assessment models are used to assist judges and prosecutors in making decisions, for example, about bail. And again, they are everywhere. They're not just in the US. The European Commission tried to regulate it, luckily in Europe. And those are models that are, again, trained on data that are biased in the first place, because, you know, if again, RS data and criminal justice data reflect the biases that police, for example, has on some particular categories, then the outcome of these models, the recommendations of these models on giving, you know, getting a person bail or not, are going to reflect those problems. So I think that's, you know, that's the two main problematic areas are these ones.
So maybe to conclude with a slight view into your last chapter. Of course, there's a lot of talk about causal inference, high hopes on this to go beyond correlations, say, between phenomena. But causality is a notoriously difficult subject when studying a policy-infused topic like crime. Yet again, it's I guess causal inference is making headway in social science as well. So you separate experimental and observational studies. Could you tell us a bit about the causality related difficulties that we find there?
Yeah, sure. So what I argue in the last chapter is that actually, and luckily, and this is one of the areas which I'm most excited about actually, is the convergence, progressive convergence between machine learning and causality research in the last years. So, you know, there was this kind of a clash of different traditions that were perfectly kind of, we can perfectly trace back to Leo Bryman's or Samuel paper in 2001, where we're actually accusing the traditional statistic culture of being too focused on irrelevant theory and stuff like that, without, you know, considering enoughly the problems of predictions that were more related to the computer science algorithmic culture. That picture changed, the scenario changed. So luckily now we are in a position in which we have economists working with computer scientists, and we have, you know, fancy artificial intelligence, machine learning, deep learning methods that are also able to disentangle causality. And, you know, causality is particularly problematic in criminology because, first of all, you have less power to deploy experiments compared to other social sciences, for example. So in economics, you have much more possibility to deploy these experiments. So experiments are, you know, considered the gold standard of causality, even though I concur with Robert Sampson, and I say that in the book, that, you know, too many times this gold standard is you know, without questioning, is problematic as well. So we have to rely a lot more on observational studies and on observational data. So data where you don't have the randomization mechanism, basically, except for some particular cases. And I think, I mean, the difficulties are generally related to the identification strategies of the problem that we have in criminology, to the fact that many times we have unobserved confounders that we cannot measure, and that kind of, you know, jeopardize all our studies. I think that in any case, one of the major problems is that probably criminology lag behind compared to other disciplines in the social sciences, like political science and economics, lag behind a bit in the training of scholars and students in the study of proper causal inference methods. So that's why we have this like plenty of studies that just look at correlational evidence. And we know without really grasping into the causal link between things that we measure. So, you know, there's a patchwork, I would say, of problems. Probably one, for starters, the fact that we lag behind the training. I think things are changing. Like a lot of doctoral programs now in criminology in Europe and in the US are focusing a lot of on quasi-experimental methods. So things are changing. And also, we have again the difficulties that compared to other disciplines, we cannot deploy experiments, and the observational data that we have most of the times are incomplete. So that creates a set of challenges that are difficult to overcome. But yeah, I mean, things are changing. I think I'm moderately optimistic about the fact that by and with the new tools that we have, and with the increasingly amount of digital data that we can leverage, criminology, hopefully, if we are all committed to it, will change for the best, and will get us closer to the answers that you know keep us awake at night. And I think the thing is that we have to recognize that we have a lot of responsibilities and we have a lot of challenges along with these promises. And if we don't act accordingly, this is going to be an incredibly missed chance for improving the quality of our research and the quality of our policies for creating a safer societies.
Yeah, fingers crossed for that, to improve the situation in our cities. All right. So thanks a lot. We've been through quite some content. Maybe if you could you give us a teaser on what you're working on currently, or is there a future book in the pipeline someday?
Someday, but not now. I mean, I just finished teaching for this semester, so I will be concentrating all summer on some papers that I have open. I'm working on with some colleagues at Bocconi University in Milan and University of Milan as well on some experiments on the relationship between social trust and organized crime perceptions in Italy. So that is one. And then I'm also working on a paper that tries to look like at racial disparities in homicide clearance in the United States. So to check whether, is it true that we had like an actual differential effect of race in the odds of having gone homicide cleared. So these are the two main things that are gonna keep me busy this summer. I have some other papers, but these are the two main ones that I think will eat up all my time during the following months.
Super relevant topics. Thanks once again, John, for our talk today. And who knows? We'll talk to each other in the future.
Sure, I'd like to. And again, thank you for the invitation. Thank you for inviting me here. It was a real pleasure, and I hope it was a pleasure as well for all the audience and all the people that listen to this episode.
Likewise. Talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Have a good one.